Hi, I'm John Trader, Director of Communications with Right Patient, the healthcare industry's only unified smart health platform offering the most flexible and scalable biometric patient safety and patient data integrity system supporting any form of biometrics, including fingerprint, finger vein, palm vein, iris, facial, and voice recognition. Our mission is to democratize and defragment healthcare, improve personal and population health outcomes, and lower costs through technical disruption in the areas of patient identification, engagement, and predictive analytics. Welcome to another installment of our podcast series where we interview industry professionals for information, analysis, and opinions on the biggest issues that face the healthcare industry. Our topic today is patient engagement, and we are delighted to have Dr. Neil Kaufman join us as our guest to discuss this extremely important industry-wide initiative that has just recently become an intense focal point for both providers and patients to help improve health outcomes. A little background on today's guest. Dr. Kaufman is Chief Medical Officer of DPS Health, an innovative technology-enabled population health company founded in 2004 and based in Los Angeles, California. After a 27-year career in academic medicine and public health, Dr. Kaufman founded DPS Health to create technology solutions that enable clinicians to help their patients with chronic disease adopt and sustain behaviors that help improve their lifestyle and self-manage their conditions. DPS Health does this by creating, implementing, evaluating, and commercializing self-management support interventions, which are technology-enabled and clinically linked. You can find DPS Health on the web at www.dpshealth.com or on Twitter at DPS Health and on Facebook at DPS space health. Dr. Kaufman has developed a deep understanding of how technology can enable behavior change interventions in the context of therapeutic relationships. His approach is grounded in behavior change and patient self-management support theories, research-based protocols, and the realities of real-world clinical practice. He has extensive experience in a variety of all aspects of health promotion, disease prevention, and clinical care. Prior to founding DPS Health, as an academic practicing physician and public health professor for 27 years, he not only provided care to vulnerable populations, he also had responsibility to plan, implement, evaluate, and evolve health and social services approaches at the individual, family, clinic, community, and governmental level. This experience, coupled with his activities regarding provider and patient education, has given him the capacity to create effective clinically linked programs that are based on how master clinicians provide care, can be linked into community resources and supports, and are enabled by sophisticated information technology support. Dr. Kaufman's company, DPS Health, partners with healthcare organizations to improve outcomes of clinical behavior change and patient support programs by leveraging clinical and coaching know-how and its proprietary technologies and protocols. It has created a state-of-art internet-based platform that, when coupled with research-proven behavior change protocols, create effective and scalable interventions designed to mimic the best approaches used by master clinicians and communicators. The approach allows web-based management and support for the patient, the coach or clinician, the administer/quality assurance person, and individuals supporting the patient, in other words, friends, family, and coworkers. It also allows a complete and time-based behavioral intervention to be customized based on the individual's personal characteristics, performance over time, and time on the intervention. Dr. Kaufman was also a commissioner of First 5 LA from 1999 to 2014, a grant-making foundation that is part of government investing over $250 million per year to improve outcomes for children by the age of 5 beginning in the prenatal period. He is on the board of directors of the Children's Law Center of California, a nonprofit law firm that represents children and youth in foster care. Dr. Kaufman received his Bachelor's of Art from Northwestern University, his medical degree from the Chicago Medical School, his pediatric training at Children's Hospital Los Angeles, and his Master's in Public Health from UCLA. The following is a taped podcast recording with Dr. Kaufman on the topic of patient engagement. Welcome to the podcast, and thank you for your time today, Neil.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Look forward to talking with you.
Great. Today's topic is patient engagement, but before we begin with our questions for Neil, let's set the stage a little bit. The topic of patient engagement is often defined as people who are actively involved in their health and healthcare to achieve better outcomes and lower costs. And there's really a growing body of evidence which demonstrates that patients who are more actively involved in their healthcare experience better health outcomes and, of course, as a result of that, incur lower costs. What we're seeing is that many public and private healthcare organizations are employing strategies to better engage patients. For example, educating them about their conditions, involving them more fully in making decisions about their care, et cetera. So a new term, relatively new term to the healthcare industry that goes along with patient engagement is patient activation, which is a term that refers to a patient's knowledge, skills, ability, willingness to manage their own healthcare. Patient engagement, as it applies to patient activation, is often defined as a broader concept that combines patient activation with interventions designed to increase activation and promote positive patient behavior, such as obtaining preventative care or exercising regularly. Patient engagement is one strategy to achieve the triple aim of healthcare, talked a lot about in the industry, which is basically defined as improving health outcomes, better patient care, and lowering costs. Furthermore, meaningful use stage two rules foster patient engagement in a simple way by stating that physicians and hospitals receiving federal electronic health record incentive payments must motivate at least 5% of their patients to view, download, or transmit their digitized health data. So despite evidence that has been compiled to date of the importance of patient engagement, there are many experts in the field who agree that more research is really going to be needed to determine best practices for engaging patients as well as to more fully demonstrate the relationship of patient engagement to cost savings. So in the meantime, considerable efforts are nonetheless underway to hold healthcare organizations accountable for engaging patients. So with all that said, Neil, can you please tell me in your own words how you interpret patient engagement and why is this an important piece of the new healthcare paradigm as an important driver of health system performance?
Thank you. I think it really is an important issue. If you look at what basically causes individuals to become sick and particularly to add new chronic conditions, for example, as they age, the vast majority of that has to do with their own behaviors. If you look at the attributable contribution to premature death, for example, a small proportion has to do with healthcare delivery. A large proportion has to do with the environments in which you live and the genetics, but the vast majority of that contribution really comes from individuals' behaviors. And those behaviors range from eating better, being more active, getting enough sleep, practicing safe sex, avoiding excess alcohol, having friends, etc. And so if we really want to try to improve outcomes, particularly for chronic conditions, which are the major conditions causing challenges in individuals' health as they age, you have to get the individual to both understand what they need to do to improve their health and to get them to actually do it. So engaging them, whether it's from the perspective of the clinician helping that patient do more, or whether it's from the individual getting the support that they need from those around them, becomes critical to improve outcomes and to also obviously lower costs.
So behavior change, you mentioned, that's a very integral part of patient engagement, but certainly not an easy task to get someone to change their personal behavior, I would assume.
Yeah, so we know that individuals' behaviors are really a balance between what the environment allows them to do easily, so making the healthy choice the easy choice, for example, having available fresh fruits and vegetables that are at an affordable price, being able to walk safely in your neighborhood, and what things you as an individual want to do. Somewhat exaggeratedly, I say that individual humans are addicted to sugar, salt, fat, and inactivity. Addict is a pretty strong word, but that basically means that our biology over eons of time were designed so that we didn't move more than we had to capture our food, and that the things that we ate, we'd hang on to them as closely as we could to survive famine. And up until the 1940s, 50s, until we secured the food source, particularly even in developed countries, malnutrition, undernutrition, was the biggest problem. That's the exact opposite now, as individuals are much more likely to have too much to eat, not the right foods, not enough activity and calorie burn to make it so that they end up becoming overweight.
And, you know, I just thought of something when you were explaining the need for behavior change. And behavior change for an individual is an important conduit to behavioral change for example, a family or a community, I would assume, meaning that when patients do have the ability to change their behavior to improve health outcomes, especially those that are caregivers, for example, for other family members or perhaps head of the household, which I know a lot of times falls on the shoulders of parents, then behavior change is as much as a community initiative as it is an individual initiative. Is that right?
Yeah, it's both a community initiative, which means is there a way to help that that entire community be more health promoting? And that community could be the place you work, it could be the place you worship, the place you play, the place you live. The family, for most people, are still the dominant unit of organization. And so individuals who live in families that are more likely to practice healthy behaviors, they themselves are more likely. And so what we know is, and we've learned this over 30, 40 years or more, that there are basic principles of what does it take to help an individual change their behavior. And there, it's not that complicated. Doing it is complicated, but to describe it, people need to have a basic set of knowledge. They need to understand what it is that they are being faced with, what are their risks or challenges, and what behaviors they need to change. Think of that as knowledge. We know that knowledge is not sufficient because many people know what they need to do and why they need to do it, but they still don't do it. They then need to have simple tools that help them to overcome the barriers to changing those behaviors. Behaviors that have been ingrained for quite some time are made part of the culture, are made more likely to happen because it's easier in that culture to do whatever the behavior is, need to be overcome, and people need to identify those barriers and have them change. They then need to identify very specific behaviors that they're going to work on and make them both measurable as well as achievable, something that can be done and it can be successful. Not the grand, I'm going to lose 50 pounds, but maybe I'll lose 10 pounds by 2 weeks or 3 weeks from now. So small steps that are measurable and incremental. You then need to be very specifically tasked with monitoring your performance that you set for yourself that says, I'll know incrementally I'm doing better if I walk more, I drink less sugar beverage, I take my medicine, I whatever that might be. Then you need to get feedback on how you're doing in some systematic way so you can see how your progress is. And then you need to get support from people around you, those who are keeping you from doing it and those who are enabling you to do it. Once you have that kind of a structure, the challenge then is activating, and I like that word, getting the person ready to go down that path to make that change happen.
Great. Thank you for the feedback on that. We touched on this a little bit in the introduction, Neil, but just your own thoughts on patient engagement's systemic influence on the entire industry. Using these personal health IT tools, which, you know, has anecdotally been proven to be great for patients and providers, but just in a couple sentences, how do you feel or do you feel that patient engagement using these personal health IT tools is good for the system overall, and how is it good for the system?
My answer would be that the jury is still out on that. I do believe they will be good, but I want to make a distinction between tools and interventions, or tools and comprehensive programs. There are tens of thousands, if not more, tools that have been created that allow an individual to do something, whether it's measure their heart rate when they go walking, keeping track of how many steps they had, monitoring what they eat. Think of those as tools that an individual who is activated, motivated, and on their path needs help to quantify what they've done to see their results. And in that regard, if that person is in that stage, they'll be helpful. For some people, they're life-saving. So a glucose monitor that's continuous that tells you if you're having a low blood sugar reaction even before you get to a dangerous level is very important. But you still need to know what to do with that information. And more importantly, you have to want to know what to do with it to then change your behavior based on it. The promise of tools is really to make it so that eventually, and I do believe this will come, it'll start out primarily with those individuals who are athletes or others who really want to know every moment what's going on with wearable technology, et cetera. But we'll get to the point where a person who is at that stage where monitoring and keeping track of certain things are helpful in their behaviors will get that information in the moment and will be able to immediately act upon that, perhaps even getting assistance from an intervention. An intervention, to me, is not just a series of tools. It basically says, who's my target population? What are their characteristics? So a 22-year-old is different than a 40-year-old, than a 90-year-old, or a 60-year-old. A person with a diagnosed disease versus at risk might be different. Imagine you've got archetypal patients who meet certain characteristics. You identify that individual target, that individual type of person who you're going to try to help, and there's, in most cases, good research on what works. How do you best motivate them? How do you get them to agree that it's ready to change their behavior? How do you help them through that? You do that over time with some degree of support, whether that's technology support, in-person support, telephonic, a friend, a peer, a leader, a health professional, and you're doing that in such a way that that individual has the capacity to take what has been most likely effective for them, self-tailor it, meaning pick and choose what parts of it they want today, and tomorrow it might be a different part, to then set their goals, monitor their performance, get their feedback, and make those changes. Until that happens, the tools, I believe, will not be effective in really changing human behavior around health-related issues. It will be effective to help me run a better 10K race or some other thing where I've already been keeping track of things and it'll keep track of them better for me. But fundamentally, if you look at chronic disease again, which is the biggest challenge that's behaviorally related, I don't think those tools are going to make major substantive differences until they are integrated effectively into intervention.
Excellent. Thank you for the feedback on that question, Neil. I'd like to talk for a moment about physician reactions to the increased effort to expand patient engagement as a tool to improve outcomes and lower costs. We've observed that there are some physicians who are openly embracing the patient engagement concept and actively using new tools and platforms to advance the movement, yet there are others who are showing a little bit of disfavor with patient engagement, citing things like technical and logistical challenges, along with a fear of potential repercussions of increasing patient empowerment. We realize that this is a traditional type of industry where doctors are trained to be caregivers. So this is a patient engagement push is changing the paradigm. So Neil, let me ask you, how do other physicians you have spoken to feel about using technology, for example, smartphones, apps, and wearables to engage with patients?
I think the answer has to start out not with whether the technology is the way, because I look at technology as enablers of something to happen. They're never, nor should they ever be, the center of the conversation. They should be the way something happens. So I think the place to start the answer is, how do physicians feel about empowered, activated patients who are participating in their disease management and actively engaged in what they do? Then the conversation can go towards whether technology makes that better or worse. And so I can only tell you a story. My dad was a doc, and I remember in the 50s, he told me a story of colleagues of his who refused to tell the patient that she had cancer, ever, and would only tell the husband, only because someone had to know. So it was so sexist, paternalistic, and absurd. My father rebelled against it. He told me these stories about how ridiculous he thought things were. That was what it was like in the 50s. Physicians were, I won't use the word God, other people have said that, but when a physician said something, patients listened most, or they pretended to listen. We know that they didn't always follow the directions, but there was never this back and forth conversation. That's not the world that I want to live in. It's not the world that I think is there, or should be there. The second part of it is people's priorities have to be taken into account when decisions are made or suggestions are made about what to do. So, for example, as you age, there's always a conflict in my mind between how long am I going to live, how many years, and how well am I going to live those years. Think of it as lifespan versus performance span. Mm-hmm. And if I can't keep the performance up to the level that I want, I don't want to keep living. That's a pretty radical statement, but I think a lot of people, I'm 65, I don't want to live till I'm 90 and be infirm, unable to pick up my grandkids or take a walk, whatever the things I want to do. So engaging the patient in all of the decisions, both their priority setting and how they want to live their lives and experience their disease, is critical. And I think more and more physicians recognize that, understand that, and would love to be able to do that. I think the practical realities of the busy clinician, whether it's the specialist or the primary care generalist, or nurse, not just physicians, but healthcare providers, is in most settings we're not given the capacity to do that because we're not given the time, even if we and the patient want that. In that context, now let me add to it technology. So if we say, hey, I could make your job easier by giving you every blood sugar your patient has, and as a matter of fact, when it gets low or high, I'm going to email you immediately to let you know about it so you can do something about it, doctor. As the doctor, I don't want to know that. I really don't think you need me every minute to manage the blood sugar or check the blood pressure. You need, that's things that the individual patient should do. I want the summary of it. I want to see patterns of it when it's not working right so I can perhaps give some wisdom if I have experience that the patient needs. I want the patient to know to reach out to me, but to barrage me every minute, even every day or every week, with more information than I can possibly use for my entire population, people are gonna rebel against that. So the question to me is not, are people adopting technology as clinicians? The question is it helping the patient, and is it helping them in this partnership to care for them in a better way? If it is, physicians will adopt it, particularly when it's easy and it fits into their workflow, particularly some macro policies that say, I don't get paid for volume, I get paid for value. So if my patient is healthier, I'm going to do better financially, or I'll survive financially. And so I'll do everything I can to keep that patient healthier. And the quicker and more efficient it is, and if tools can help me to do that, I'll certainly be more likely to do that. So it's not just changing physician behavior, but it's really changing physician and patient mindset, changing the context in which care occurs, and sometimes even the financing of how care is delivered.
There's some really interesting points you made there, Neil. And one of the things, main things that I took out of it is that it seems like with the onset of the onslaught, I should say, of these health IT tools and platforms and wearables and apps, that there's a lot of education that needs to go along with them to patients, to providers, to learn how to manage the flow of data and learn how to manage how to use that data to, as you pointed out, you know, the bottom line is improving personal health, improving health outcomes. So that's really good points. Thank you for expounding a little bit on that.
Let me add one other thing.
Sure.
We keep using the word data. I think of this field as having four different kinds of, I'm not sure what the right word is, data, information, knowledge, and wisdom. And we can't confuse those. Data, to me, is the simple mathematics. What's my blood pressure today? What's my weight? What's my glucose? It's facts that come in with no information, no interpretation. Information is, what do those facts sort of mean?
Mm-hmm.
Whether, is it going up or down? Is there a trend this way or that way? Knowledge is the basic understanding of what that information is trying to tell you. And wisdom is what to do with it. And I'm afraid that currently we have a lot of data and some information coming to patients and to providers, but we have less knowledge and wisdom. And when you have less knowledge and wisdom, what all of us, I would believe, tend to do is to either hyper-focus on one data element, which may or may not be reflective, because statistically it's no different than before. That's what the information and knowledge helps you to sort of put those into perspective. Or you just shut it down and you say, I just got too much information. I don't know what to do with it. There's too much data, too much information. Give me that knowledge and wisdom. And so the best interventions take the tools that provide the data, translate it into information, and provide some knowledge, and then allows the person to self-discover, allows the person to generate the wisdom, and sometimes that does come from within, sometimes that comes from people around you, peers, friends, others who have the condition, professionals, etc. When you have that continuum happening, you're much more likely to get the result we're talking about, which is better understanding, changing your behaviors, which then leads to those outcomes we're all looking for.
Thank you so much for that additional information, Neil. Let's switch gears for a moment. I want to drill a little bit deeper into technology as it applies to patient engagement, as particularly technology on mobile devices. To provide you with a little bit of background, the global patient engagement solutions market is expected to grow from approximately $5.5 billion in 2014 to $13.7 billion by 2019, which is approximately a compound annual growth rate of about 20%, according to some research reports recently released. What we're distinctly observing, though, is that healthcare providers, payers, and patients around the world, especially in the United States, are increasingly purchasing these solutions, these apps, these health IT platforms. In addition, a plethora of other factors are driving the market, including the Affordable Care Act, meaningful use, the popularity of mobile health, a rise in the elderly population, and the need for better worker productivity and incentives from the government. So these patient engagement solutions to help hospitals bring down costs, reduce the amount of readmissions, boost patient outreach, improve the quality of healthcare, and even help them get a return on investment. Additionally, the move towards value-based care and the focus on patient experience is going to also fuel the market in the future. Yet despite all these benefits that we're seeing from patient engagement solutions that are brought to hospitals, they also come with a few challenges, some of which you've touched on, which are a relatively high price tag and the security of patients' information in addition to what you've already pointed out. Other hurdles in the way are a lack of health literacy for a big portion of the population, disjointed user end market, poor access to healthcare, and some other things. What we're seeing globally, though, is North America is making up the majority of the global market due to the increase in healthcare costs, the move towards quality care, legislative reforms. We talked about the rise in the elderly and the chronically ill population and government incentives. However, globally, we're also seeing European and Asian markets expecting to experience growth because their governments are pushing health information technology and patient engagement and the demand for quality care at lower costs. So with that background in place, Neil, can you tell me how significant a role will mobile devices be in the push for increased patient engagement across the healthcare industry?
I think they're going to be quite transformative. I began seriously thinking about this about 10 years ago, really looking at how to help a single clinician care for large numbers of people one at a time. So it's that merger of a personal health approach, a single clinician with a single patient, but doing it with large numbers, but still individualizing and personalizing. That to me is the paradigm that we should be thinking about, and that we should be recognizing that while each individual is unique and technology has the capacity to let individuals self-tailor their experiences and identify the things that make the best sense for them, we also have large populations. 75 million Americans have prediabetes, or even 150 million have chronic conditions. A huge percent of adults have more than one chronic condition, 25% if you're 45 to 65, and 35-40% if you're over 65. And so we know that there's a pent-up requirement for this. So the question really becomes, in what way can technology be used to help individuals better manage their condition? So yes, I think it will be quite a game changer. We've seen that beginning ways by the number of people using technology, mainly, as I mentioned before, as tools. But we're also seeing an increasing number of interventions being created focusing on either hard to reach, vulnerable, underserved, expensive patient activities. So at the one extreme, if you look at the very, very sick individual, the easiest example is a person admitted to the hospital for congestive heart failure who then gets discharged. And because of financial incentives, but also it's great clinical care, you don't want that person readmitted. And so by being able to have that person in the home, have their blood pressure, their weight, their medication monitored as things get worse, for example, weight gain, you know that they may need additional medicines, you can avoid hospitalization. The other end that people have spent most of their time and effort on are basically the healthy and wellness programs. And certainly those can help individuals and will modify the way that over time those individuals stay healthy for a long period of time. The area that I'm personally much more interested in, though, is not the very sick and not the well, and I think the place where technology will have the greatest future return is really that 25 to 35% of the people in the middle. We call them the emergent risk population, and those are individuals whose behaviors are causing them to increase the number of chronic conditions they have at an average of one every 3 years, and about 10 to 15% of them transition from being moderately sick, not in the hospital, not in the ER, but still costing about 10 times what a healthy person costs, to becoming very high cost and their organs not work. So it's this tsunami of people in that moderate risk, emergent risk population in the middle, which has a very good capacity to improve outcomes by helping people change their behaviors. Once your heart has failed and it's got no more muscle left, I might be able to keep you out of the hospital, but eventually you're on the way out, so to speak. But right. When you're that group in the middle, you can make a major impact.
I was going to actually, part two of the question was to ask you if a patient engagement mobile strategy should differ based on socioeconomics. But based on the feedback on that question, it sounds like more that it's socioeconomics doesn't have as much effect on successful patient engagement based on what you said.
Well, actually, I would say that it does. If you look within, and let's just use that emergent risk population as the one, for example. We know that if you are affluent and pre-diabetic with hypertension, high cholesterol, and overweight, let's give you those four conditions, you have the capacity to afford healthy foods. You have the capacity to join a gym because you can afford it. And the strategy of how you would approach that person doesn't have to worry about as much the economic cost of the change in your behavior. If you are a low-income individual with those same conditions, same age, same risk, same everything, and you live in a neighborhood that has no access to fresh fruits and vegetables, that is unsafe to walk, and is a very different kind of culture or environment, you'll need different support. So I really would say that the best of these interventions will identify these archetypal patients, so more educated or more wealthy or poorer or someone who lives in a rural area that can't really get to a group or whatever archetype you want to have, and then you would create the capacity for those approaches to be self-tailored by that individual based on some of those characteristics, based really not only on the characteristics but also how they respond to the approach that's being used. Because technology has this capacity to modify the user experience based on past performance. So that happens on the internet when we get ads all the time. Imagine a banner ad that's trying to sell you something comes in blue and you don't click on it, but when it came in red, you clicked on it. Well, the next banner ad's going to be in red, so to speak. I mean, you can do it to millions of people. They're called A-B comparisons. Well, you can do the same thing by setting up these interventions of the future that have the capacity to self-tailor, or I'll pick the color I want, or predict based on prior characteristics and prior performance, prior engagement, what's more likely to frame the message, to say it in a way that you will therefore respond to it, that you'll buy it. And I'm not selling the whatever, the clothing, I'm selling health or behavior change, but it's the same principles. And so they do need to be personalized for socioeconomic, for age, sometimes for gender, sometimes for ethnicity, certainly for the chronic conditions you have, the risk factors that you have. And that's what the master clinician does, if you think about it. A master clinician, when a patient comes to see him or her, has the ability pretty quickly, almost intuitively, to say, without stereotyping, here's my hypothesis of what this person's biggest challenges are and how they approach it. I'm going to ask a few probing questions, perhaps open-ended, perhaps helping them self-disclose what's important to them, to be able to understand, therefore, I'm going to suggest this or that. I may suggest both, but I may weight the way I suggest them a little bit differently. It's not because I'm wishy-washy as the clinician, it's because I know I'm predicting how that patient is going to respond. I'm going to let them pick and choose. Technology needs to do the same thing. That's when we'll have interventions that work.
So it sounds like, Neil, that successful patient engagement is very much a factor of the ability to personalize and custom tailor these patient engagement solutions to different populations.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
You start out with sort of the generic personalization. So, for example, programs we create are for older Americans, older adults. They would work fine if you're 20 or 30, but you won't like it. We specifically and fundamentally said, what would a person average age 55, plus or minus 10 on the bottom and 20 or 30 on the top, use technology to help them improve their health outcome? And we then iterate it multiple times, understand, get feedback from users, et cetera, to be able to continue to improve it. But it's a very different approach than one that might have been designed for the same risk, the same, what sound like same conditions, but for a 20-year-old, et cetera. So you have to do things both by age, depending on the issue, sometimes by gender. And I think interventionists know how to do that. And the promise of technology and the use of big data over the next 5-10 years, if you ask me sort of where that might go, is the ability to take a large population. So we have a health plan giving us 85,000 people who are in this emergent moderate risk. And we're going to outreach to them. We're going to educate them. We're going to activate them. We're going to engage them, not expecting to change much behavior with any of those first phase, to then raise their hand, enter into a program that helps them self-manage their condition, lower their stress, eat better, be more active, different conditions or interventions. But we're going to learn from those 85,000 trying different messages and different technologies and approaches what is most likely to work, so that when we get the next 85,000, we segment that population based on what we've learned, and we then message them, offer them, provide them the opportunity to pick things that they're more likely to want to use. Kind of like the way the internet does it for what book you should read, you know? What books did you buy? And maybe you'd be interested in this one. The same tailoring can be done with technology.
So patient engagement, it really seems like it's not a finely tuned instrument. It's an ongoing learning process, and it takes experience. It takes actual implementation of patient engagement strategies to determine what is going to be the most effective outcome. So I appreciate the feedback on that. And actually, continuing with that theme, Neil, it seems that one of the recurring problems with patient engagement is not only the initial hurdle of convincing patients to take a more active role in their own care, but also motivating them to do it on a consistent basis. In other words, the struggle for technology providers doesn't seem to lie as much in creating patient engagement health IT apps and tools that may be useful and beneficial, but rather in their ability to motivate patients and providers to use these tools, these apps, on a regular, consistent basis. So with that said, Neil, what insight can you provide on how the healthcare industry can inspire patients and providers to consistently engage with technology as part of an overall push for more widespread patient engagement? A tough question.
It's the big one. I think first, don't expect a secret sauce that's going to be patentable and that kind of stuff.
Right.
I think it'll come down to a better understanding of the population you're talking about. So we're talking in a population approach. We're not talking individual one-on-one, but you're given a population, health plan members, healthcare provider, patients, employees, people who live in a particular community, whatever that population is. And first is, whatever you can, learn as much as you can about the individuals in that population. So take HRA data, health risk appraisal data, take electronic medical record data, take claims data, take even consumer behavior data, anything that you can that will teach you in general about the population and also allow you to understand and track individual experiences based on their characteristics. And when you're doing that, you're basically able to imagine what is most likely going to be effective with that individual, but you recognize that you're just imagining it. You're coming up with what you think is the most likely to be effective, and then modifying it in such a way that it learns based on what the last experience was. If you're a clinician and you say something to the patient and they give you a blank stare back and you're too intuitive or attentive to what they're saying, you're going to realize, this didn't get across. I need to say something else. Technology needs to have the very similar experience. And so you do that. That's sort of the first concept. But even in addition to that, the concept says we cannot expect the intervention to begin when the person enrolls. The prehistory of how they got there, how they heard about it, were they ready to use it, had they gotten to the stage where they understood why they needed to do it, all of those things are part of it. So the way we think about it is, you take your population, and try as best you can to generally give them the knowledge and information so they can make wise choices that they want to try something. And you may do that over time. You may have to talk to that person, I guess I'd better say communicate with that person by a range of modalities over time, not just once or twice, but maybe many, many times over 6, 10, 12 months or longer, waiting for that person to raise their hand and say, I'd like to learn more. I'd like to try this. Why is that hand going to get raised? It may just be cumulative information over time. More likely something happened in their environment. Maybe their father just died of diabetes or their best friend had a heart attack or something happened that got them to realize, oh, you were talking to me. I need to do something about it.
Right.
Oh my God, you know, I'm going to try something. So if you're not there when that happens and they raise their hand, when the light comes on in the room, so to speak, you're not going to be there to help them. And then a month later, they may have fallen back in there. So the question becomes, how do you create this ecosystem of information support, helping people become ready, moving them along that patient activation scale, so to speak, or the readiness to change scale. So if they are ready, you work with them then. If they're not, you help them to get there. But the way that you get them there determines in many ways how they see the support coming in. And if you get them there by cajoling them, by bribing them, by only giving them incentives, but not getting them to realize why it's important, it's not going to work. For me, incentives may help get you to open the door or to raise your hand. But if that incentive was really big, you know, a whole bunch of money off your health insurance, you're probably not going to change your behavior. You're just going to do whatever it took to get that incentive bonus, so to speak, but not really make behavior change. So I'm not against incentives, but I think we need to really understand what kind of incentives work in which phase of the person's experiences, whether it's the I'm thinking about it, I've already started, I'm losing my energy, I need to get, you know, reactivated, reengaged.
Excellent insight, Neil. Thank you. One other thing I wanted to add on to those outstanding points that you made is that I think one of the other keys to patient engagement is patients. And I don't mean patients as in individuals coming in to see a doctor, but patients as in a virtue. Because from my observations on what I've read and researched on patient engagement, I think just like a lot of things in life, we expect immediate results. So implementing a patient engagement strategy, it takes time and it takes a lot of fine tuning and a lot of adjustments. And you certainly pointed out there that the motivation doesn't necessarily lie in incentives, but rather turning that light bulb on, as you pointed out, getting patients to connect the dots, so to speak. So that's a really important aspect of successful patient engagement. Thanks again for that extra feedback.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Behaviors that have taken a long time to get there have been important for that person, have been protective, have helped them in some way. We don't do things that are not in our best interest, even if they're not in our best interest. We think they are, or we act that way. So to get someone to change their framing, to get them to think in a different way, is going to take a long time. Now, it takes a long time to get to that health risk status. It takes a long time to take that risk away. So the other good news is that the person doesn't need to radically change their life to make a big difference. If you just drink one 150-calorie soft drink or soda a day less, you can lose a significant amount of weight. And that's not that big of a burden. So people don't understand that. If you cut your cigarettes in half, it makes a difference. Obviously, if you get rid of them completely, it's even better. But people don't have to go all the way to perfection. They really need to make those incremental steps. And our job is to help them to see the benefit from that, to feel good about the fact that they've done that, to overcome their feeling of failure when they haven't been able to get all the way to their goal, because it does take incremental activities to get it there.
Great, thank you. Many studies prognosticate that increased patient engagement in healthcare has the potential to save billions of dollars per year because patients and providers together make healthcare decisions that are informed by medical evidence and tailored to specific characteristics and values of the patient, a couple of things we've touched on earlier. Neil, can you tell us, in your opinion, what you feel the potential financial impact of increased patient engagement is in the industry? And also, in addition to improving health, how you feel patient engagement financially benefits both the patient and the provider?
Sure. So there are a number of ways that you can think about this. I think you have to first recognize that if you're talking purely cost, Let's not talk about health. Let's not talk about, for this question, anything other than financial. You have to have people who are costing money. Now, sure, you could have a person who's going to cost you money 5 years or 10 years from now, but that gets discounted. And that's very important. And I'm not saying we shouldn't be thinking about saving money in the long run, and that's certainly societal's best interest. It's a public good. But if you want to help healthcare providers, plans, employers, and individuals save real money around healthcare, you have to be thinking, working with people who are now or very soon going to be spending a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So automatically, the majority of the wellness programs are going to have a bigger challenge showing a healthcare-related return on investment. They may show value for many other things, including productivity and other things of that nature. But if you're not costing that much and you spend any amount of money to make it happen, you're not going to be able to save much money. So that's the first sort of paradigm, that you have to be sure you're targeting the right individual. You then have to be targeting the behaviors that we know matter for people's health status and for their expenditures. So, for example, if you have type 2 diabetes, mm-hmm. and I meticulously manage your diabetes, and you have no complications, your organs are working fine, but you're early stage, I don't save a penny by getting you actively engaged in your diabetes care. You go to the doctor 4 times a year. You used to go 2 times a year. You get your blood tests. You get your eyes checked. All of these things cost money. You take all the medicines you're supposed to. All of those things cost money. The only way I save money is if you have end organ damage, and I'm keeping you from getting it worse. Those are called complications. But if we're talking early stage, or more importantly, I keep you from getting another chronic condition, or keep you from in the next year or two, getting very, very sick. The very, very sick people understand. You're on your way. Your organs are beginning to fail. If I can keep you from falling off the cliff, I can save you money. And I think people understand that. It's challenging to pick out of the 100% of people with early stage diabetes or recently diagnosed diabetes, how many are going to go to complications, but it's about 10% a year. Wow. So in 2 years, 20, 25% of people who had diabetes this year without complications get it, but it's increasingly people are trying to figure out how you tell who's going to get it, complications, but you don't really know. But what we do know is that individuals with diabetes or other significant chronic conditions add another chronic condition every 2 or 3 years. Take sleep apnea as an example. So overweight, pre-diabetic, or patient with diabetes, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, gets rule out sleep apnea. Now all of a sudden the doctor has a whole new diagnosis to think about. There's a protocol. I got to get a sleep study and I got to do this and that. And then they get a CPAP machine that helps them at night to breathe better to improve their outcome. And they have to have all this medicine and other stuff that happens. It costs a lot of money. If I prevented you from getting sleep apnea, I'd save you money. And I can do that in a year or two. So you have to look at what are the preventable things that cost money that are preventable by patient activation. And we know, for example, improving lifestyle, losing weight, eating better, being more active, taking your medicine, following your doctor's advice, lowers the rate of adding new chronic conditions. That's a different paradigm. And most facilities, most plans, providers, employers are not thinking about that segment to be able to demonstrate that they're going to save money. They're still thinking about keeping that patient out of the hospital who has end organ damage and was hospitalized last week for congestive heart failure. So part of it has to do with picking the right patient and picking the right outcome for which a behavior can make a difference.
Thank you for the insight on that question, Neil. I'd like to shift our discussion to the topic of wearables, such as Fitbit, Jawbone, Apple Watch, some of the other ones that are out there. Many are predicting that fitness bands and other wearable devices will begin a transition to serious health tools this year in 2015. And according to some of the research that we've seen, the use of health-oriented wearables is going to triple between 2014 and 2018. Yet there's a research firm that says shipments of wearable electronic devices for fitness will decline to 68.1 million units in 2015 from 70 million in 2014. And sales are predicted to rebound in 2016 as people buy other devices to do similar jobs, spending money on things like smartwatches, smart bands, and related fitness devices. Although the wearable market explosion has created a lot of hype about the benefits of using these devices for personal health management, there seems to be a little bit of a gap in capturing wearable data. And we talked about that word data and how you interpret it and turning it into something meaningful for individual and population health, the wisdom part of what you mentioned. Neil, can you first tell us what your thoughts are on wearables playing an important role in increasing patient engagement?
I think for at least 3 to 5 years, and I'll tell you why I think it will be different 3 or 5 years from now. I think for the next 3 or 5 years, wearables, I can't predict how many people will use them. I imagine it will go up, but I think very little at a population level impact on actual health, health outcomes, or healthcare expenditures will occur. And I think that of that for a couple of reasons. One is, with the exception of in-home monitoring or wearables for the very, very sick, or glucose sensors for people with diabetes, things for that have been around a while or that are very high cost, like the hospital readmission for congestive heart failure, et cetera. The majority of people I predict who are going to purchase wearables and use them for anything longer than a month or two are going to be younger, healthier, more fitness-oriented people. That's almost why you call them fitness wearables rather than health wearables. I'm sure they're going to measure health-related vital signs and other things, but I doubt the 60-year-old pre-diabetic, low back pain, mild depression patient with hypertension is going to do that, maybe for blood pressure, but not for all of the other things. So I think that's going to take a while for that to actually spread into the population that is in this emergent risk and some of the very sick. I think the reason it's going to take a while for that to spread is what I said before. Data and information will quickly get stale. It won't be that helpful to somebody once they've done it for a month or two. It's not going to tell them that much, so I think people will stop using it. But more importantly, if it's not coupled to the knowledge and wisdom and intervention and barrier mitigation and social support and all the things necessary for that individual who needs to change these lifelong behaviors, it's just going to be noise. I predict that 3 to 5 years from now, we and others will have created more and more of these integrated interventions in which tools become important elements, but they're not the star. My basic premise is that technology enables things to happen, and when technology is the star of the show, it very rarely does that. And technology and wearables are the star of the show, and you need to have them be created in the image of the intervention, the support, the wisdom and knowledge the person needs to have to be able to make a true difference. The challenge with that is how do you pay for it? And people can pay for it themselves, and that may be one approach, and it wouldn't surprise me that as risk gets shifted to patients, as deductibles get higher, as health savings account and other methods are even more popular, that people are spending more of their own money on their health, that might happen. But it really happens when the payers, which means employers or health plans and at-risk healthcare providers see value in it and will actually pay for it. That will happen, but with great challenge, because if you require randomized controlled trials, by the time the trial starts, not finished and evaluated, the technology is obsolete because of the 1 and 2 year cycles that these things go through. So you have to have a different paradigm. We could talk about that if you think the audience would want to hear about it, but suffice it to say, we're going to have a big challenge getting to those improved outcomes within a healthcare ecosystem without payment for it, and therefore you need the evidence that's good enough to make that happen. So I see that as a challenge that is added on to the challenge of getting people to feel that it's giving them that knowledge and wisdom they need and support they need to improve their outcomes.
So first of all, thank you for indirectly kind of calling me out on the definition of the term wearables. I think most people tend to associate that with these fitness bands that track your heart rate and the number of steps you take, et cetera. But as you pointed out in our conversation, in your answer, a response to this question, that wearables don't have to be fitness trackers. They can be glucose monitors or any type of device that's used by a patient to monitor any type of self-physiological activity. So that's the first thing. And the second thing that I gleaned from what you said is that the data that comes from these wearables, unless it's able to be turned into wisdom that can be used immediately by a patient, it's kind of no good. It's not a situation where it can sit on a shelf and fester for you know, 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years. It has to be extremely actionable, and it has to be actionable quickly. So those are the two main things I took out of what you said. And I also wanted to ask you, Neil, if in the course of, I know you are very active in the healthcare community, both as a physician and as CEO of your company, have you run into any situations or any case studies where we've actually seen wearable data producing actionable results that have improved health outcomes for patients?
Oh, yeah, of course. If you look at the literature on glucose monitoring, for full disclosure, my wife works for Medtronic as a chief medical officer and has glucose sensors. So if that's considered a conflict, I will acknowledge it. But if you look at the longest history of a wearable that's been able to provide information to patients, obviously checking your blood sugar without sticking your finger and now using a continuous glucose sensor has been demonstrated to make major impacts in individuals' glucose control. So that required not just knowledge of not just the data that you could get from it, but actually what that trend meant, what did I need to do about it, how do I manage it. Eventually there'll be a pump that does it all for you, but until that's there, your pump or your insulin injection or your diet, physical activity are modified by the individual. So clearly that one is the poster child for the one that's been around the longest. I think if you look at other behaviors, giving people feedback on how many steps they've taken, it's a fairly simple technology. It doesn't have to be sophisticated. Even if it does it inaccurately, by the way, there's some pretty good suggestion that people still will move more and will continue that. So yes, it can make a difference. Again, when they're embedded within the context of a therapeutic relationship, in the context of more information, knowledge, and wisdom of what to do with it, then I think we're able to demonstrate that does make a difference.
Thank you so much for the additional feedback, Neil. Let's prognosticate for a moment, and I want to ask you, if you were to create software or an app that sums up patient engagement in a nutshell, what would that software or that app look like? What functions would it perform, and how would patients and doctors interact with it?
I'm going to take that as one of those, what would things be like 5 or 10 years from now?
Exactly.
Not think about what we could do technologically today. The pace of these technological changes is just breathtaking. But imagine that you have an individual who has decided and is interested in changing their behavior and is able to get assessment in the moment of a range of different characteristics of that person. So what is their vital signs? As you mentioned, heart rate, blood pressure, respiratory rate, et cetera. How are they feeling at the moment? And that could be in an automatic fashion, or you could just put down a number on a scale. That's called ecological momentary assessment. It means in the moment, in your own ecology, an assessment is made of your status, of how you're doing. Person with diabetes would be their blood sugar. An asthmatic would be how they're breathing, but it's also, are they having any symptoms that are going to let them think that they're going to have an asthma attack? So it's not just the symptom of the condition, it's the precursors of what make that condition worse, if it's that kind of a condition.
I see.
So imagine that you're assessing all of that at the same time. And then imagine that this assessment analyzes it and says, oh, in 20 minutes, you're probably going to have an asthma attack. Or in 30 minutes, you're going to want to smoke a cigarette. Or in 40 minutes, you're going to get hungry and you'll eat too much fat. I'm not saying we could do it exactly, but imagine it could do that. It could make these predictions. You would then have an intervention that gives you an ecological momentary intervention. So you assess it in the moment, you get the intervention in the moment. It's a micro intervention. One of the concepts that I think really makes a big difference in thinking about this is each person in any one day has hundreds, if not thousands, of micro decisions, small decisions that we make every day, not one of which is important, but the sum of which determines our outcome. And imagine if we could have those decisions informed in the moment by what our status is, what our characteristics are. You could then, over time, begin to intuitively know what your status is and not have to look at your wearable every time, because you can begin to feel it. You learn what is it like to have a cigarette craving. You learn what is it like to feel a half hour from your asthmatic attack or your high blood sugar or your low blood sugar. And you then automatically know what it is you're supposed to do. And then you can monitor the fact, okay, I tried it. did it work? I was getting that asthmatic attack. I did something different about it, and I didn't get it. Well, can I learn from that? So imagine that you've got this amalgamation of something that gives you increased motivation, understanding, recognition of that you can recognize it's important, the capacity to want to do what we're talking about, the support to make it easy for you, and then the way for you to learn moment to moment what happens. That's the paradigm for blood glucose control. So the individual, whether they're checking their blood 6 or 8 or 10 or 15 times a day or getting it continuously, is learning to anticipate where their blood sugar is going to go based on what's about to happen. I'm going to eat, I'm going to exercise, I'm going to have stress, whatever it might be. And they then modify their behavior based on it. Well, imagine if that were done in the moment. And you could shut it down when you don't want it because you don't want to overload, but you could have it there for you when you're doing it. That, to me, is the beauty of something that's with you all the time, because your phone is with you. Uh-huh. It's the beauty of organizing it in such a way that is personalized for me. It's the beauty of being able to have the things that matter to me, because I can control the things that I monitor. I can control the things that I hear about, because today I'm going to be working on this. Maybe in the morning I'm working on this, in the afternoon I'm working on that, or for the next week I'm working on that. I get to pick and choose it. Then people will be engaged. Without that, if you're just giving me the data, it's going to quickly dry up. And interventions that are being built that way in the future will be built on all of what we know about social learning and cognitive learning, the cognitive theories and individual behavior change approaches that use this new technology to make those things more effective.
That's a fascinating look. It tells me that there's a lot of work to be done. It's very difficult to get people to change. As we talked about earlier in the podcast, it's very difficult to get people to change their behaviors, but that's really a fascinating look at what really makes these platforms, these apps effective. And that's, being able to change that behavior, but also at some point take a step back, see what's working, what's not working, and make the necessary adjustments. And that's something that I appreciate your insight on, because we don't get a chance to tap into a knowledge base as broad as yours to get some insight on what may happen with this market in the future. So I appreciate that. Let's continue our conversation on the topic of empowering patients to take more accountability for their own care. We talked earlier at the introduction about the widely used term patient activation, which we defined as boosting a patient's knowledge, skill, confidence, basically enhancing their ability to manage their own health and healthcare. The industry seems to be struggling a little bit with motivating and incentivizing some patients to be more active in their own care. Neil, what can you tell us about how the healthcare industry can better activate patients to be more responsible and accountable for their own care? Again, I know you've talked a little bit about this during the podcast, but can you expound on that a little bit?
Yeah, so I think there's sort of two ways, one that's practical and one that's philosophical. The practical says understand where people are at, understand what support they need and help, and give it to them in whatever manner they want to have. And to me, that means if they want to get support in person, on the phone, online, on a cell phone, in a group, one-on-one, the health system, anywhere across that ecosystem should be able to provide that. And that's going to be much more likely to be effective across a large population. But I think there's a more fundamental value, and it's actually the reason that I do what I do. And it has to do with the ability that as we age to live the life we want to live, to be able to have the capacities to do the things that are important to us. And each of us have different priorities for that. And your future vision of what you'd like to be when you're 80 or 90 might be different than mine. And it almost certainly is different. Different priorities, different activities, different things that make you happy. And summarize performance span. And I believe that healthcare has gotten away from performance span, if they ever were there, and more towards lifespan. And I don't just mean the last 30 days of somebody's existence. If the goal of healthcare is to continue your lifespan, regardless of your performance span, or another way, if you're not spending time and effort increasing someone's performance span while you're increasing their lifespan, people are not going to be engaged with you. People care about the things that they want to do. They want to spend time with their spouse or take a walk. And particularly people who are not very, very sick, who don't even think of themselves in the sick role, even though they might have three or four chronic conditions, don't want to think about being sick. They want to think about life as a resource of everyday life, as a resource for living. So I think the more we can have healthcare engage people in such a way that they know we care about what they care about, we know and demonstrate that we're helping them to meet their own personal goals for what they want to do with their lives, they'll be much more likely to engage with us, and by the way, improve their health outcomes, lower their costs, be more satisfied, you know, all the other things that we as clinicians and healthcare system want to see happen. So it really has to do with the recognition of the centrality of that patient's priorities and having a health system that can be responsive to it.
That's an interesting point about the healthcare industry being more in touch with patients' personal health goals. I know, you know, 5-10 years ago, I can't imagine in any office setting where a doctor saw a patient that the first question that the doctor asked the patient is, what are your personal health goals? But I know for a fact that when I went to see my doctor for a routine checkup, maybe a month or so ago, the very first thing he asked me was, what is it that you want to be? What health do you want to achieve? And this is a younger doctor, and he was very technologically savvy, but what I liked about the conversation and the way it started, as you pointed out, is being more in touch with what my personal beliefs and my personal goals were, where I wanted to be. So that's a really important point I wanted to add on there, because adding on to what you said, I think it's a paradigm shift, and it's getting more in touch and in tune and respectful of where patients want to be, what it is exactly you want to accomplish with your health. Obviously, everybody wants to be healthy, but are there certain things that you want to do to get there that I can help you with? So I think showing empathy and showing a deep sense of understanding and care of what a patient wants to accomplish is a big part of that.
So I think many of the people listening might say, oh, we've begun to do that with what we call shared decision making. Mm-hmm. Well, that is one manifestation of it, but that's usually focused around a very specific question. I diagnosed with breast cancer, and I have three different options. They each have different risk profiles, et cetera, et cetera. Which am I going to choose? That's an important shared decision making, and I feel like that's what we need. It's not keeping it from the patient like my father's colleagues used to do. My point is, that's not really the only thing I'm talking about. I'm really talking about much more fundamental than that. And there are choices in the medicines people are given, in the type of changes that are asked of them, that make them more or less likely to be able to do the things they want to do. If it's got a side effect on the vision and somebody loves to read, or a side effect on balance and they love to walk, you might change what medicine the person gets or what recommendations you give based on their preferences for the life they want to have. And the more you show that that's, as a system and as an individual clinician, great to hear that your doc asked you that, the more that we as clinicians and as our systems can do that, given the constraints and given all the challenges, et cetera, the more likely we are to be successful. And so infusing that value into technology that supports it, again, not at the star, but as an enabler of that philosophy, is what I think will really rule the day.
Thank you, Neil. I'd like to get your thoughts on how to make sense of myriad new patient engagement tools on the market and the confusion surrounding which are the most effective to achieve the goal of improving outcomes and lowering costs. In other words, as with any industry, competition certainly dictates the availability of these health IT tools and wearables and apps that are on the market. So let me ask, with such a large influx of patient engagement tools flooding the market, how can the healthcare industry avoid patient-provider confusion and overload and direct patients to the most applicable and effective platforms? Is it simply just education? Is it just an education push, or is it more than that?
Boy, I'm so glad I don't have to make that decision or help a health system make that, because I don't think there is an effective way. I think part of it has to do with in your heart, in your soul as the healthcare system, are you doing this to actually improve outcomes? Are you doing this, and this is a fine reason, to improve patient loyalty, improve brand effectiveness, improve your own image? And I'm not saying that's bad, okay? I'm just saying, if you look historically, majority of programs that are being put out where a health system or an employer or a provider is telling people about things that they've heard of, applications that work, they don't necessarily expect to change health outcomes from that. And they're doing it to show that they care about the patient, which is great. They're giving the patient information, letting the patient make choices. All those things are important. If I truly was responsible for improving the quality of care and or the outcome the patient had, I would not require randomized controlled trials only as the way to determine whether something made sense, but I would look at what is the theory and research behind whether or not this application, this intervention, this tool, whatever part of technology we're talking about, has been given enough experience in a large enough group of people for me to be able to predict that it's going to work in my population. I would then presumably want to try it out with a large enough group of my own patients to then see if they're giving me the kinds of results that I care about to offer it to my entire network of patients. I don't mean paralysis by pilots and having thousands of them, but policy-relevant pilot where I will have tested the hypothesis that this does actually change behavior and change outcomes in ways that I care, lowers the rate of getting new chronic conditions or whatever the outcome that population is at risk for, and then be able to deploy those with a realistic expectation that I'm going to both improve health and lower costs. Short of that, I think most of the recommendations are not going to be based on, nor should they have an expectation of improving outcomes, because as I think I've tried to say a number of times, I'm not convinced that tools, not in the context of interventions, will probably have much impact on the people who we really want to impact.
So this is very much a trial and error type of thing where these apps need to be properly vetted by these healthcare institutions before they can make recommendations. It's not simply just reading a review on a third-party website and deciding based on that review, this is applicable to my patient population. It's very much a testing to see what works best and then making recommendations based on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can certainly learn from colleagues who are similar to you. You don't necessarily have to do primary research yourself. And increasingly, there is a growing evidence base of organizations who have gone to scale with various programs. But it does require some degree of thought of what outcomes you're really looking for and what can you reasonably expect to get. And then obviously the cost of getting those outcomes is always important and to be measured. I am skeptical that any of the just randomly selected apps that are seemingly doing well with individuals who have fitness and other healthy reasons for them will probably translate directly into improved health or cost savings in the bulk of the rest of the population.
Thank you for the feedback on that question, Neil. Finally, as we like to do often on our podcast, Neil, we want you to, and you know, I'm going to actually strike one part of this question because you already answered it earlier, and that was, if you had a crystal ball and were able to envision what the perfect patient engagement app was, what would that be? And you answered that in very, you know, excellent detail. So what I'd like though to ask you is, in your opinion, as far as looking into the future, why is it important that patient engagement in healthcare continually evolve?
I think there's a couple of reasons. There is I'll use the word battle out there for the hearts and minds of the public. There are many different ways that individuals in their own environments can think about ways to improve their health. So there is a direct-to-consumer approach. There is an approach through healthcare. You want to think of them as competitive. In some ways they are. And the direct-to-consumer approach often is very rapid in its changes, typically has less validated research approaches, often meets the aesthetic and immediate needs of the individual because it's been designed as a consumer product and comes from a perspective of selling someone something. Some of them may be highly effective. Typically, we don't know. And patients are increasingly using them, and they should be. That's fine, particularly if it's meeting their needs. But if you think about healthcare 20 years from now or 15 years from now, what is healthcare going to be? Is it only going to be intensive care, inpatient for very, very sick people, And all the rest of it is going to be self-managed through direct-to-consumer or other mechanisms. Forget the financing of it. Forget how it's organized. But fundamentally, it used to be that you had to go to the doctor to get the information. You know, go back to the 50s. And then all of a sudden, you could get a lot of information from the Internet, sometimes more than you ever wanted to know. But imagine if you got to the place where technology could actually deliver you the knowledge and wisdom that you needed to make better decisions. And you don't need to go to the doctor except for a procedure that you don't know how to do on yourself. And maybe someday you'll be able to do some of those.
That's
and
a scary
when
thought.
You're very, very sick, or, thank you. But, you know, we do procedures now. It's checking blood.
That's right.
You check your blood yourself. When I was starting my practice, we did urine tests for diabetes. All of a sudden, you have blood, self-blood glucose management at home. Home pregnancy test, home HIV test, a lot of stuff that you never could do before. So take it to the extreme. Healthcare might end up being purely the body shop, the car shop, where you go when your car is broken, when your body is broken, and they'll fix it. So if it's not going to only be that, and if it's going to have more of this other elements to it, to be able to engage that person and show value to that person so they'll vote with their feet and their pocketbook and their clicks online and not go only direct to consumer for where they get the things that they think they need, healthcare has got to evolve. And it has to evolve into a model where we meet the needs of those patients as consumers while we're meeting the needs of those patients as patients, or those individuals as patients. And that will happen as we hope, I hope, individual health systems or health ecosystem is incentivized to improve people's health. So value over volume. It doesn't matter what procedures the person gets or what gets done to them or with them. It matters what their outcome is. And then we'll quickly realize that a lot of that outcome is in the hands of the individual and in the behaviors of the individuals, of the knowledge and attitudes and skills of that individual. And our ecosystem will be designed to maximize that while we're also there to fix the car when it's broken. Because you need that, you know. You're never going to do heart surgery, and neither will I. But many other things that we can do. So that, to me, is the long-term vision of why healthcare has to transform itself. And technology will push healthcare, whether it's kicking and screaming or with open arms, we'll find out. It'll push it, and it will see whether it wins or not against the less regulated and less scientifically valid, but highly effective in marketing and maybe effective in actuality, direct consumer approaches to that person's health.
Excellent. Thank you for the feedback on that question, Neil. I'd like to take a moment and thank Neil for offering his insight on the topic of patient engagement in healthcare. You can follow Neil and DPS Healthcare on Twitter under the username @DPSHealth or visit their website at www.dpshealth.com. Neil, I just want to personally thank you so much for your time today and for making yourself available to discuss this topic. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. I learned a lot just hearing the kind of questions you were asking. I really appreciate it, too.
This concludes our podcast for today. We hope that you enjoyed the topic and our guest and encourage you to tune into future podcasts where we interview industry professionals on topics that relate to the healthcare industry. For a full list of all of our podcasts, please visit our podcast page at www.writepatient.com/healthcare-biometrics-podcast. If you have an idea or a podcast topic you would like to see us cover, please send an email with the topic idea and a suggested industry expert for an interview to jtrader, that's J-T-R-A-D-E-R, @writepatient.com, and we will put that on our calendar. Thank you again, Neil, and see you on our next podcast.